So, welcome everyone. My name is Daniel Ford. If you'd like more information on who I am or where I'm coming from, you can check out my website at ancestralmedicine.org. The focus of the talk tonight will be, The focus of the talk will be, I'm calling it deities, ancestors, and archetypes, expanding sacred vocabulary. So that's a pretty esoteric topic. Let me say in less esoteric language, I think, that what I've observed over the last 25 years, more or less, of being a student of world religion and spiritual seeker and someone immersed in different practices is that a lot of folks who grow up in the United States and other places, but that's been my life experience here, and who are drawn into spirituality in some form or another, don't come equipped with what I would call a developed archetypal palette, with developed vocabulary for the different faces and aspects of the sacred. And so it's a deficiency that is not present in all cultures. Some cultures actually equip people from the start, just based on how they're set up, to have a rich vocabulary for thinking about different aspects of the sacred. And so it has gradually occurred to me over the years of being also a teacher and mentor and priest and ritualist for others, like, wow, this is a weak spot. This is a blind spot in our culture. And I have come to see that it's something that people can very intentionally address. And it's a little bit of a strange topic or a strange way to come at it, to say, look, this our culture is weak in this area. Let's shore that up by intentionally understanding why it matters and then doing things to remedy it. So that's the angle at which I'm coming at this topic from. Not rooted in one specific tradition, but looking at a pattern that cuts across a lot of different traditions. And so one way to think of it, it's a little goofy maybe, but it's as if the three influences in a lot of or maybe two influences in a lot of modern American culture, generalizing here, is some form of Christianity or scientism, which is going beyond science per se, which is fantastic, and I love, big fan of science, to an actual worldview that's very materialistic or very reductionistic and has a kind of arrogance that says only physically observable realities are true, so to speak. So many scientists don't take it to that level, but some do, and sadly can come with a lot of judgment or arrogance toward others who are open to relating with other realities. And so if you have only those backgrounds, that doesn't equip you to understand the diverse expressions that underlie this reality. And you can think of it like you have three or four crayons. But some cultures, you have the 64 kit or whatever. You have a lot of different diverse ways to think and talk about the sacred. So we're talking about archetypal richness versus archetypal deficiency. The word archetype, just to place it, it looks like A-R-C-H-E-T-Y-P, archetype. And it's popularized by a Swiss psychologist, Carl Jung. And it's a very useful concept. And he's basically saying there are different patterns that run across many cultures that can be generalized to be sort of collective patterns or collective energies within the human psyche. So the warrior, the priest, the lover, the magician, things like that. I don't completely ascribe to the view, but it's a way of saying there are different patterns that we can come to bring more conscious in a useful way. Okay, so a few assumptions that are going to inform what I have to say about this. One is that how we understand the sacred or the unseen or the mystery or whatever you want to call it, the bigger soup that we're swimming in this, in reality here, is going to also naturally inform how we approach human culture. Specifically, and this is a generalization here, but I think it holds true, that cultures that have an understanding of the sacred that includes a lot of diversity are going to tend to be more tolerant or even embracing of diversity within human culture. And so if our map for the sacred is like there's just one God, and God's personality is like this, and there's just one or just a few manifestations of that God, singular, in this reality, that doesn't give us a lot of archetypal diversity to work with. And so there will tend to be a sense that everybody needs to conform more or less to that pattern. Kind of stifling, potentially. If you say, on the other hand, that the energies that we observe in the natural world, which are extremely diverse, are the physical bodies or the extension of all these other magical...
Yeah, I'd like to listen to this for about a half hour, have 20 minutes or so.
Somebody just came off mute, so I'm going to mute that person. Okay. If you say that the natural world is the map for the sacred, and the natural world is extremely diverse, including human form, then you would expect that that diversity of form would also be reflected in human society and culture. And so that leads to a more life-affirming and diversity-embracing approach to human culture. So it's one of the ways in which this topic is actually really important. And so I'll say another assumption is that this stuff can be learned on purpose. It doesn't have to be something you're raised with. And so let me give some examples of how it shows up in popular culture first. So astrology. People love to know their astrology, whether they know anything about it. It's like, oh, I'm a Libra. I have an Aries moon. Like, I have a Gemini rising. And some people on the call are probably like, now I know about you, you know. And so I'm excited about it too. I don't even get into it that much. But anytime someone gives me specific feedback about what my magic number is or about what my type of whatever is, there's a part of me that's like, I'm curious about that. That we have a natural, understandable desire to know our specific place, our specific destiny, our specific needs and temperament. Another example would be Enneagram, any system that looks at different types, the Myers-Briggs test from, are you an INFJ or an introvert, an extrovert? Are you more judging or perceiving? There are psychological tests that try to characterize your particular needs and handling instructions. Divination systems like tarot, I Ching, in Ifa Orisha tradition from Yoruba-speaking West Africa, we have elaborate divination systems. But systems of divination often include a lot of articulation of different aspects of the sacred, and then those come out and speak during any given divination. And so that's exciting to people when it happens. I was watching, binge-watching on Netflix some like Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. kind of like comic book stuff. And I'm like, wow, this is totally compelling because it's looking at these different superpowers and giving a different face to, like, which superpower would you have or who would your superhero be, right? That's totally the same thing we're talking about. In psychology, even the popular, like, what are the five love languages? Like, I like acts of service. I don't need gifts. If you want to be nice to me, help me. And so that's different than other people. And so anything that allows us to say, I'm this way, I'm not this other way, and that's okay, is an example of what I'm talking about. That happens on a fundamentally, like it happens on a sacred level within religious systems that tend to have a lot of diversity around this. Like within Christianity, I don't mean to be thumbs down around Christianity, but I would say that within different lineages of Christianity, it's my sense that mostly Catholicism has a developed language around this with the saints, and even that is a bit limited in a certain way, because there are only so many different personality expressions that are really embraced. Examples of traditions that have more developed vocabulary for it, for example, Hinduism, South Asian traditions, whether it's through Vedic astrology or all the different deities in the pantheons of Hinduism. And so someone can be very a devotee of Shiva, and they're not expected to have the same temperament as a devotee of Krishna. It's okay to carry this medicine and this energy and to be a child of this god and not this other one. Native North American traditions, which are, of course, extremely diverse, not always, but oftentimes, will recognize that the beings that we think of as animals and plants and places are the face or the extension of a very intelligent, complex, ancient deity or, like a god form, like a very complex spirit, and that certain people carry that medicine or they carry an affinity with that spectrum of energy. Like if you're a salmon person, you're connected to the rivers and all the things that salmon are, you're not going to be expected to show up in the same way that someone who's very coyote or has a very a strong affinity with what we think of as trickster or playful and other things, energies. And so because generally speaking, a lot of Native North American cultures see the land and the extended web of relationships as sacred and as the manifestation of the holy, then that same understanding is applied to human beings. And so because there are 300 different things you might be able to think of in the natural world, there are at least 300 different ways to describe an energy that is coming at you in another person. And that gives you information about how to relate with that energy too. In Yoruba tradition, in the specific West African tradition that I happen to practice, we talk about the Orisha, the deities, and there are many of them. There are maybe only 20 or 30 that get a whole lot of press, but even within that, even having 20 or 30 different established priesthoods, there are a lot of different temperaments that come through with that. The temperament of Obatala is very different than the temperament of Oya. And so you don't expect an Oya priest to be mellow. They might be contained, but there's an intensity that is just part of their nature that's going to show up a little different for somebody who's a priest of Oshun or Obatala. So different people have different destinies and express different qualities of the sacred. To someone raised in that framework, totally obvious statement. It's like, why do I need to be in this call, Daniel? This is remedial. But we don't get that. Most people don't get that. We're raised in modern American culture. And that's problematic. And let me speak to some of the ways in which it's problematic. If you don't have a vocabulary for different ways to be, you're going to tend to be judgy and not accepting when people are other ways, for one. So there's a failure to appreciate, like if you're super aligned with the very like flowery, expressive, connective, relational energy of, you know, the fresh water and what in many traditions might be goddesses of beauty and love and river energy and rain and sweetness and fertility. And you have someone in your life, male or female or whatever, showing up, holding the energy that's very volcanic and connected to iron and the boundary setting, martial and super structure favoring and justice oriented. If you don't have a way to appreciate that, you might mistake it as out of balance when it's actually quite doing just a fine job being itself. Like we would not ever think that swans have to behave like hyenas. Like swans are not more sacred than hyenas, but if a hyena catches a swan, you can see where that's gonna lead. So they're different temperaments. There's nothing wrong with hyena energy, right? So you get the framework that I'm coming from. We need, if we're to show up in a way that really respects soul level fundamental difference in other humans, we need some kind of vocabulary just to bring it conscious. And another reason that, let me speak instead to what's helpful about having the framework of any sort. And it's a lifelong process to develop a more and more rich vocabulary to talk about sacred difference. So the more you develop the vocabulary for yourself personally, one of the benefits is self-understanding. You get to be yourself in a very specific way. You don't have to be other things. You don't have to be all of the things. The hyena is not having an anxiety attack because it's not a swan. It's just like gets to be hyena, full tilt. And that's great for the hyena too. Like, so you get to be yourself. And you also get to learn what's bad medicine for you. In Ifa tradition, especially when you do initiations, but also when you get a reading, you end up with taboos. They can last for a few months, or if you do an initiation, it might be a whole lifetime. And some people might have a taboo against, let's say, jumping in and rescuing others. Somebody else might have a taboo against withholding generosity. And so, like, hyena probably has a taboo against, like, swimming in the ocean, let's say. Like, shark doesn't have the same taboo. And so, knowing what your handling instructions are for what your specific formula for balance is in your life can save your ass. It's a really important kind of knowledge. And so that's useful. And if you want to relate well with people, let's say like your partner, your parents, your children, your friends, knowing what their handling instructions are is great too. And you're not going to bring, you're not going to give, we don't give bird seed to our cat. And so there's a thing about knowing what the archetypal configuration or this, knowing what gods your friends are ruled by, so you know how to relate with them, and, or your partner, whoever. And so getting, developing the vocabulary for difference makes us more skillful in relationship and helps us to more accurately see or reflect other people so they feel good being around us and we're less lonely because people come around us because we're able to see them and not insist that they be like us and not insist that they be different than how they are. To the contrary, we can actually catch it when someone in our life is being contrary to their own nature. It's like, hyena, why are you dressed up like a swan? This is not, it's not your jam. Don't do this. Like, you need to be hyena, right? And so there's an appreciation and an emotional satisfaction from seeing other specific forms of beauty. When, like, I have the blessing in my work to encounter a lot of people in session space. And when, you know, and everybody's different. And sometimes people come with a very specific, precious kind of energy. And I'm like, oh, wow, you're a rare bird. Like, good for you. I don't know if anyone's actually noticed that about you. And so sometimes the fact that I've had the good fortune to develop a little bit of a vocabulary puts me in a position to be able to mirror back to someone. I'm like, oh, you have a particular connection with the lightning spirits, which, how's that going for you? They're like, damn, how'd you see that? Or how'd you know that? And it's not that I'm psychic, but I have developed a vocabulary for naming difference. So that can be learned. On a practical level, if folks had any version of the type of worldview that I'm describing, our politics and our legal structure around difference would be a lot better. Because a lot of the things that suck on the level of social policy and the times we're in and all of it can be understood through the lens of really not respecting difference and imposing one specific way of being onto others. And so, yeah, let me just leave it there to not tank the energy. And a couple more thoughts, and then we'll shift into dialogue space. I want to say that developing a vocabulary for the sacred is an antidote to possession, to archetypal possession. And that's a strange esoteric thing to say, so I'm going to unpackage it a little bit. This comes from a Jungian perspective generally, or depth psychology perspective. So going back to Carl Jung's teaching on the archetypes. And from his perspective, the archetypes or the deities or the gods, they're not distant from our everyday life. In fact, most people are somewhat possessed by them. And possessed doesn't mean you're in a state of like that you're necessarily in an altered state or some kind of trance or something. It means that your sense of who you are is fused with or merged with a particular energy or pattern, that you think that is what you are. And so if we call in Orisha tradition, Ogun is one of the names we use for the soldier, spirit of iron, of metal. And so some people who are cops, soldiers, working in that that domain, no judgment about that inherently, they might psychologically be identified with that energy in a way that they're not. The advantages of being a little bit possessed by one of the archetypes or the gods is that energy can move through you. It can you can channel it, basically, which feels good. It's kind of exciting, and it makes you feel bigger than you are, and it can allow you to do magical things. The disadvantage is that you get a sense of ego inflation, that your sense of who you are gets bigger than is balanced and bigger than is useful. And so the antidote to that is to be like, I'm me, I'm a person, I'm a human, I work with my ancestors or the gods, but I'm not Ogun. Like, I have an Ogun shrine, I love Ogun, but I'm not that deity. We're not the same thing. And that's actually quite important. It's quite important to have ego strength and a sense of separateness from the spirits so that you can relate with them rather than unconsciously identify with them. And so think of it a little bit like you're, like you picture the mandala or medicine wheel geometry where you have concentric circles and your sense of self is at the center. You want it to stay empty. Like if you're the goalie and all these other deities and forces and gods are trying to take over your center, you can choose to do that ritually in certain contexts, but basically you want the center to be open and empty so that you're not unconsciously identified with any given force that's bigger than you, because then you your sense of who you are gets, you become annoying typically to others and potentially dogmatic. And the risk is that then you start to see the world only through that lens. And your flexibility of consciousness tanks. It goes way downhill. And so the, you know, I mean, everybody knows people like this. And times we've been like this ourselves. When we're just like, this is what it is. In my early 20s, I converted to Islam for a minute. And I was studying Arabic and Islamic culture and Sufism, living in North Africa. And I was totally annoying to people close to me because I had it. I found the truth. It's like, that's great, Daniel. We're really happy for you. And it was off-putting. I'm like, sorry, after the Muslim phase. But and I'm not saying, you know, and Muslims are inherently like that. I was just young and inflated. And I had I was drunk on how it felt to allow these bigger forces to move through me. And a lot of spiritual teachers get drunk on that. And it's okay to get drunk, but like it's not okay to be an alcoholic. And so you can get in a state of possession and be like, woo, this is what's happening right now. And then you need to be done with that the next day and be like, all right, I got to pay my taxes and respond to emails and everything. And so if we don't even have a language for the kinds of things that could take us over, we're much more vulnerable to being unconsciously possessed by these patterns. And so developing a language for the different forces that we're made out of and that make up reality allows us to understand when they're operating, to honor them, and also to disidentify with them and to create space from them when we need to. That's really precious if we want to be a well-adjusted person and not just have only one mode of operating, of showing up in the world. Another way of saying what I'm trying to convey is that flexibility of consciousness is a trait of wisdom. And if you want to become a wise person, an actual elder who's hopefully also kind and helpful, one of the things you would strive to develop is flexibility of consciousness, meaning you can show up in a really nurturing mode. You can be really clear and grounded and boundaried. You can be totally combative if you need to be. You can just shut your mouth and listen if you need to. You can be really wildly creative. You can do all kinds of different things, but you don't have to because you're not identified with it. And when other people show up with those qualities, you can be like, hey, how are you using that? How's that working? And you're not afraid of other things. You can go into it, but then you can step out of it. And so if you want to do any kind of leadership, that's very useful. A good queen or king helps the people that they are responsible for stewarding to feel seen and to feel understood. And so you can't have that quality if you're not in touch with like your inner hardworking farmer, and then like the farmer shows up to hold court with the queen, and you're like, you're not in touch with it in yourself, that person's not going to feel seen by you. So the more you've developed your vocabulary for different ways of being, the more you can meet the energy that's showing up in your life in the moment. All right. Two more things. As maybe a takeaway, and then we'll be in dialogue here in a minute, but as a takeaway, where would you start to develop this language for, you know, diverse different ways of being? Well, a couple things. I'd say try, if you can, to go deep within one or maybe two systems. Don't only nibble on the surface. So find a system that's really feels, brings happiness to your soul, and go a bit deep into that if possible. Two different systems, so to speak, that can work anywhere. One is if you have a place that really feels like home to you, or let's say you just moved to Mount Shasta or some other place that's like, this is going to be home now. You can choose to learn the land there as a vocabulary for the sacred. You'd be like, okay, there's the start of the Sacramento. There's volcanoes. I'm living by a stratovolcano. Okay, there's pine trees. There's black bear. There's all these different creatures that are here. Let me learn at least 100 of them. So I can say, here are 7 types of trees that are amazing. Here are 4 types of stone formations. Here are, you know, 15 of the different mammals and 8 amazing birds. And to know, how would these patterns look in human form? How does flicker feel different than bald eagle, feel different than raven? And to know that the land where you're at is a completely lovely ancient vocabulary for sacred diversity if you're not sure where to start. So that's one place to start. Get to know where you're at, because you're not the first one to do that. The indigenous people there, or even the earth tapped in people who are not necessarily blood indigenous from there, but who lived there before you, have already been doing that. So the creatures of that land are used to the humans being curious about them. The other way to get more diverse energies into your awareness and space that doesn't require any outside belief system is getting to know your own ancestral lineages. It's a lot of what I teach. If people have been interacting with me, you've heard me go on about it. You can hear me go on about it on the website and the recordings. But for the sake of what we're talking about here, we each have many different lineages, but I encourage people to consider 4 primary lineages. So think of your 4 grandparents, whether or not you'll ever know them, and the lineage of men before your grandfathers and of women before your grandmothers. On just those 4 lineages, on back through time, each one, if you go back far enough, is anchored in some very specific and magical and interesting aspect of sacred energy. And you can get to know that, carve out that pathway of connection, and claim it in a really not culturally weird way, because it's your own people. And bring that good energy in that very specific way into your life in the present. The quality of energy that I am fed by on my mother's lineage is different than the quality of energy in my mother's father's lineage. So, and et cetera. So you could think of 4 bundles or baskets of blessings that maybe you haven't unwrapped or explored yet that are gifts from your blood ancestors. So just getting to know the land where you're at and the lineages that gave birth to you is a great starting point for expanding the vocabulary for the sacred. So I think that's my monologue. Thanks everybody who's on a call. I see there's some people here. That's nice. I would love to hear questions that arise for you. I think for audio purposes, it's going to be great if you type them, if you can. If you're on video and you raise your hand, then I might be able to see you. And otherwise, I still don't know how to make a space for the phone people to ask a question without unmuting everybody, which I may do at some point. But let's see if we can get a few questions from typing or... if you can unmute yourself, that's great. Yeah. So let's open it up. So thanks, everybody, for your attention and engagement so far. What you got? Anybody? It's kind of in a groove, so I hope something lands from that. Help me out. Somebody asked something. I just keep talking if you want. Great. Thanks, Nikki. Allison, are you, you got something? I'm going to unmute you there.
No.
Sorry.
No, I don't have anything. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Yeah, you're good. I'll put you back on mute. Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
No, it's good. I love how you said what you said. The diversity of the exterior world, how it kind of ricochets around and creates our interior world. Brilliant, lovely. And I don't think you addressed it. If we don't have that rich inner spiritual vocabulary, we can get kind of hard and crusty. You mentioned something like that in the...
Yeah.
The write-up. I thought that was kind of interesting and important to, I'm really struggling about how to hold my own like spiritual center and still relate to the great father in Washington.
Is that what we call it?
Well, I don't know.
It's a great something. Yeah.
Yeah, no. Right?
Complicated.
Wow.
Yeah.
The great orange clown in Washington. I don't know. Right. I mean, I kind of want to be respectful, but it's really hard, I got to say, okay?
Yeah, no, I know.
So trying to, like, marry all these pieces kind of in
I want to believe about that for one, it's our responsibility, if we're even moderately conscious people, to double down on that, to be really, really well within ourselves. And to really just be unapologetically really fucking good with ourselves and to be passionate even more about being well human beings and caring for the people in our sphere of influence. Okay. So step one, don't freak out about the political situation. It's like freaking out. If I thought freaking out helped, that we'd all like freak out and it'd be really helpful, but it's not. So that's the main critique of freaking out is it's not that helpful. And so... So dig in, and then the way we're going to be most useful is we need to specifically do a really damn good job of being specifically you.
Nice.
And so, if your job is to make like really, really good stained glass windows, then you need to up your game this year and make extremely good stained glass windows, whatever, like whatever you do. It like there's a call to I'm not saying it's only about that, like there is a need to like have more cultural healing and awareness and everything, but if we allow the political discourse to dominate our sense of what's important in life, then there's a loss of bigger perspective. Like the even if suddenly the narrative in Washington and on all state and local levels is like, we really need to be celebrating religious plurality and genderqueer people and have reparations and a national truth and justice reconciliation for the dual genocides our nation is founded upon, and more equal distribution of wealth and all the good things, all the like good progressive things. There's still, most of the beings are still not at the table.
Yeah, exactly.
Meaning the trees, the animals, the elementals, the land, all the other powers are still not at the table.
Right.
That doesn't mean we don't desperately need all the intra-human healing. We absolutely do.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely. And there's a view that is needed for the long haul as our population density continues to just wickedly increase, that brings back into the dialogue the 50 to 100 species that are going extinct every day on Earth because of human habitat destruction, the destruction of their habitat by humans.
Yep.
And so now what do we do about that? So do we freak out more? No. Hold the big picture, be really good to people in our lives and engage where we're moved to engage, I think. But there's not just one way to remedy the situation. And it's going to take at least a couple hundred years to get things turned around, probably. And so it's a work of many lifetimes. So make good use of this lifetime and die well and come back and get busy.
Amen.
So,
all right.
Yeah, I think.
Thanks, yeah.
It's a good question on the chat. I'm going to go ahead and thank you, Allison, and
you.
Your audio. Marissa, about having contact with the ancestors of the land where you're living, they're certainly a part of the ecological, the ecology of what's present wherever you're at. The way I spoke of it, it's as if there's your ancestors and then the non-human land. But of course, the human ancestors are part of where you're at. And it's my protocol, I guess, to seek to respectfully introduce your own blood ancestors to the ancestors of the land or place where you live, and to know that some among them may welcome respectful contact, others may be like, meh. And so to not push the issue, but if they come to you or if you want to respectfully approach them, I think that's just fine, and it can be part of respectful inhabiting in a place. If I imagine having theoretically 100 people who are all in a nice community here in Asheville, and we all want to tend with the spirits of the land, what's going to happen is it's some people's affinity to work with the human dead. It's other people's affinity to do plant, you know, diplomacy with the green-blooded worlds. And other people's calling to work with the birds and some with the rivers. And so where it's good to notice where in the wide, diverse spectrum of forces outside of you, you're drawn. So one of the advantages of doing ritual work in community is there's not a feeling like you need to tend to all the things. You get to specialize in what you're doing and not have to carry all of it because other people are holding their peace. But we, in modern culture, rarely get that. And it's super sad. Most people I meet, if they're being honest about it, have a longing for a more healthy culture. And one of the things that longing is about is having a culture that lets you be your bad self. And you don't have to do other people's thing. You get to love them and appreciate them being themselves. And I'm not saying we don't have that at all, but most people I know, myself included, wish we had it a bit more. So I like that. Thanks, Marissa. It's a good question. Yeah. Others want to jump in? I think phone people, you can actually unmute yourself. So I'm going to stop worrying about that. So.
Can I... say something?
Yeah, go ahead, Melissa.
So with the idea of being in place, I've had the, I guess, advantage or luck to have lived in, or drawn to live in places where the father side of my family has, you know, died and toiled, and now I live in Atlanta in the same place where they moved forward from, in West End, Southwest Atlanta. And that's where they ended up after being in Crawford, Colbert, Georgia, in Madison County. And so I wonder about, so I feel very connected to that side and have a lot of dialogue with that side or connection. And I wonder what, though, about the other side, the white side, the ones that I also work with. How does that work? If you're like in a place where the ancestors of the land are probably yours, with the ones that
are not. Yeah, it's good. Let me give it. It's a rich question. Let me give a rambly answer. There's a great talk I heard years ago. Unfortunately, I forget the presenter, but she was with a group of people that was invited to ask a question to one of the Tibetan oracles in exile. I think she called it the Blue Oracle. So it was an elder Tibetan woman who would go into trance and bring through messages. And so their group thought up the question, how can we be a force for healing? And so the oracle woman went into possession with the spirits and brought through a very specific answer. And part of it was, when you marry two religions in your heart, you'll be a force for healing in the world. It's like, okay. And guiding a few thousand people in the last 12, 13 years in ancestral healing work, that same feedback applies strongly to the lineages that we are comprised of in our own heart. I think of one trainee who is a fantastic, very courageous woman, whose mother's side is African-American, father's side is African-American, and also, or no, mother's father's side is Irish, because her biological grandfather raped her grandmother. And so her journey of claiming her European ancestors also as guides, once there's been the healing, even though there's conception through rape and all of the chargedness of that as an African-American woman, has been really healing for her in the sense of holding them to account and be like, okay, you can be like that. So we're going to, like, we got karma now. We're going to do this. And to do the difficult, courageous work of harmonizing those, not just harmonizing those ancestral lineages within her own heart as a formula for being in her power and in her specific medicine of giving back to the world what she has to offer. So I'm like, wow, that's bold. Like, good for you. Yeah. Way to do that. And so I think that you're asking the right question, and it's a question that has to be lived. So you could frame it as, once my mother's lineages are well and my father's lineages are well, ritually, how does that feel and look to have them harmonized in my own heart?
Right.
And as a really rich braid of blessings that's part of who you are. Right on. That sets up an energy internally on a soul level of a kind of healing and reconciliation that you can then anchor in the world for others.
Okay.
It's a kind of lived... It's a medicine. You're making medicine out of ancestral pain, and it's a medicine you're entitled to make because of who you are, specifically. Okay. So it's good. And one other thing I was going to say is, it's a little bit related. In Orisha tradition, one of the questions people are obsessed with, and it's a little misguided in a way, is what Orisha is on my head? Who's my head Orisha? Who's my main deity? And the Cubans talk about it sometimes like that. But in Nigeria, in Yoruba land, the more traditional, I don't mean it judgmentally toward Caribbean lineages, but the traditional African and West African orientation of practice is not necessarily that way. Like, through my Ifa initiation, because of the Odu that came through, the divination signature, people would probably see me as kind of a child of Eshu, but I'm not initiated to Eshu. I'm initiated to Ifa and to Batala and to Oshun and to the ancestors. And people can initiate to multiple priesthoods, and it's totally normal. It's totally fine. And so there's not just one thing we're made of. So initially, coming up a little bit through Cuban lineages, I was conditioned to see people like, oh, what's your head Orisha, Melissa? What's your, you know, and then spending time in Nigeria, it's like, oh, it's actually more nuanced than that. It's like, what are the five or six energies that are especially important in your configuration of energy for you to work with to really realize your destiny? Mm-hmm. And that question feels a little more nuanced. So I like it better that way. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that's you. It's like, what are the aspects of the sacred that you personally need to actually devote time relating with in order to be the best version of you? Because there's not time to have, you know, 50 different relationships with different deities. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. But that's yeah. Really yeah. Good. Thanks, Melissa. Yeah. It's good to see you. I'm gonna put you back on mute. Aaron, I see your question. How does one make ancestral lineage as well? It's a big question. Send me an email after if you would, and I'll send you the link to the talk. That's my main jam and what I teach to a lot, and I have a book coming out on that. And so I would probably bore some of the regulars if I talked to that in such great depth. But the short answer is you got to go back to before the trouble and connect with the well ones, which is often almost always before remembered names. And it's often pre-colonialism, pre-Christianity, pre- whatever messed your people up, pre that, and connect with the older ones who are really in good shape spiritually, partner with them, and then ask them to intervene to heal what's between them and you. That's a very short formula. But reach out directly, and there is another talk like that. And so just send me an email, and I'll follow up with you. Same with anybody on the call. Others have questions about superheroes or diversity or whatever we've been talking about tonight. I see somebody typing. I'm going to be patient. What are you drinking? I'm drinking gin. Because I can. No, it's a habit I picked up from doing E5 practice. And whatever, I sip on gin. I get nervous when I teach, so that's what I do. My elders in Nigeria hit the gin hard during ritual, and it kind of makes for more fun ritual. So I appreciate the humanity of it and the kind of craziness of it. So, and respect to sober people and whatever you need. So good. Others have any questions or objections or anything? Look, if you take away nothing else from the talk, one of the things I really want to be adamant about, the really weird, magical, life-affirming, interesting approaches to the sacred are learned things. They're not automatic just because you're born into a native or an African or a traditional whatever body. They're learned. If you take full-blooded native people out of a traditional environment and raise them Mormon, they'll most often end up with the Mormon way of seeing the world. Blessings, no disrespect to Mormons, but I'm saying like culture is learned. And so the good thing is if you're motivated, you can learn new things. And just sinking into one framework for sacred difference can really be a catalyst to be a more tolerant, curious person in how we approach other people. And I see a question from Nikki. Are archetypes just different ways of interpreting the same global energies, or are they patterns in our collective unconscious or conscious? I think those seems like similar. The same like that. Carl Jung would, I think, have said, not to speak for the wizard that he is, but I think you would tend to see them as collective, like patterns in the collective psyche of humanity. Now, he's a European male, white male, writing in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And so he's, you know, bless his heart, but still a bit of an armchair colonialist. And so there's a tendency to not totally appreciate just how diverse the patterns are. But there's also something really precious to where he's coming from. I remember asking a teacher, Louisa Tisch, Yeyeoshun Miwa, Fajimbola Fatumiche, so she's a respected elder in Ifa Arisha tradition. So if I'm here, I'll modify the question, but same question. If I'm here in Asheville and I'm approaching the spirit of the French Broad River, is that Oshun? If she's a river goddess? Like, how's that work? Like, Oshun's the deity of the Oshun River in Nigeria, no doubt. But she's gone global. And so, how's that work? And her response was lovely and nuanced. She was basically saying that she sees it as like a court where there are many different goddesses in that family of goddesses, and that if we were in the Oshun River, we would approach Oshun, and if you happen to be a devotee of the goddess of the Sacramento River, you would give deference to Oshun there, but be like, hey, I'm a priest of the Sacramento River and respect to Oshun here. Now I come here, I'm going to say, hey, spirit of the French Broad River, I happen to be an initiate and priest of Oshun's mysteries. I want to approach you respectfully. Are we cool? So there is a, within these big patterns, there's still a respect for uniqueness and difference and diversity. So think of the archetypes as a bit like group level energies. It doesn't work to be like, you know, hey, you're an Asian person. Hello, Asian person. I like Asian people. It's like, whoa, totally awkward. Like, you have to go beyond the group level thing to be like, hello, specific human, how you doing? I recognize you may be part of a group that on some level is different than the group I'm a part of, but like, we're going to hold group as part of what we are, but still recognize individuality within that. And so I think it's like that with the deities and with the archetypes. And yeah, so there's a dance of navigating different layers of things at the same time. So great. Thanks, Nikki. And I'll say it's a rich question. I mostly really like Jung's, what Jung talks about that I don't hear religious traditions talk about that I think he's very clever on is the topic of possession. So if you want to focus in on one thing from the labyrinth of Jungian psychology, which can be really actually snobby, professionally and intellectually snobby, sometimes usefully, sometimes not, is understand really in a gut way what he and other Jungians mean by archetypal possession, what it really means to be possessed by the deities. Because I've seen it happen in ritual space in a way that's just lovely. And I've also seen it happen unconsciously and psychologically in a way that's totally problematic, totally dangerously problematic. And so it's a hazard, especially in ritual work. Once you start opening up to otherworldly energies, that you get stuck. Like you get stuck in a big collective energy and you can't dislodge or come back to your center. So, good. Okay, we got just a few minutes. If anybody else has anything, it's welcome. Yeah, Aaron, let me take you off. You're unmuted. Go for it.
Hi. I was wondering if you could speak more about helping someone find out that maybe they're not in line with the right type of energy that you believe that they are and should be in line with in order to be fulfilling themselves in these ways.
Yeah, that's a good question. In Ifa tradition, we do it through divination. When people go for divination, they're going to get called out by Ifa or by whatever powers are being invoked for divination. Beyond that, it's more of a question of being able to see someone accurately. And it's like we don't have one system for doing that necessarily. People who are, how to say, it's a specific kind of gift that not everyone has to the same degree, and the people that do have it a bit haven't cultivated it to the same degree. But the gift is something like being able to accurately mirror and reflect back to people what you perceive in them on a soul level. And if you, for most people who have an even slightly intact sense of self, if you say something that's not accurate, they're going to be like, eh, it's just not, it doesn't land. But if you say something that really lands, they're either going to be like, oh my God, I feel so seen, or they're going to have that like, wow, I need to get out of the room right now. This is so uncomfortably vulnerable. I don't like it, or whatever, or just a sense of like, cool, say more. Wow. Because a lot of folks, because it is, Alex, where are you typing a question? A lot of folks go through a whole life without ever being seen on a soul level. Totally sad. Totally super sad. Because we're not very good at it culturally. And so, yeah. It's kind of my day job, I guess. I mean, it's that particular skill is one I feel decent at, or I have sought to cultivate, is the reflecting back to people, or, you know, seeing what I see in them. The way a lot of people do it is get a lot of different consultations and gradually feel you do like a hotter, colder, be like, oh, I felt really seen there. I felt less seen there. And you gradually gravitate toward, you get in the neighborhood of authenticity. And if you can just be in that neighborhood, you're ahead of the curve. And then within that, you start to refine it. And once you're basically where you need to be, then it's like, go deep, get really good at it. Yeah. No, it's good. Thanks. To your question, Alex, how do we find out what our taboos are? Is it by Ifa reading? I mean, just the notion of taboo. Let me name it here. There, I do have a recent blog post specifically on taboo. I wanted to speak to a construct in Yoruba culture that's quite important for traditional Yoruba religion that we don't tend to have in this culture in quite the same way. And I do have a blog post on my site called Taboo, Honoring Sacred Difference, where I go into that a bit. But if you are wanting to approach things from a Yoruba framework, then the way in which taboos are determined is typically through divination, through readings. That's right. So, good. Well, we're at time. If you want to be in the loop about what I'm doing, I send out an email a month, and that's where I share about stuff. So send me an email, seriously, or just go to my site, sign up for the newsletter, and that's how you know about upcoming talks and all that. But I'm teaching kind of all over the place in 7 states so far this year, and have a book coming out on ancestor work in July. And the next real training of substance will be in February in Portland, which has a residential option, which I'm happy about. So if you need to come in for it, you're welcome to that. And thanks, everybody, for your time and engagement and attention, and really good to have you on the call. And respect to all the people that I can't see. I don't know who you are, but thanks for your engagement. I appreciate it. I'm going to stop recording.